Thank you. My name is Frank Milos, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Lamont Oaks group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which meets in Palos Heights, Illinois, on Monday night between the hours of 7:30, which is the time our beginners meeting starts, and 8:30, which is the time that our regularly scheduled closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous takes place. And my sobriety date is November 3rd, 1971. I hate doing this in the morning. No, it's only because I'm not a morning person. It's not like I do a hard time being here. I mean, I'm supposed to be here. This is very important for me to do that. But I'm just not a good morning guy. I mean, the best thing people do in the morning is stay away from me. It's not that I don't want to be a good morning guy. I'm just not. And I stopped fighting that years ago. And early on, in most of my life, I went on the attack. Of course, I'm good at that. That's kind of what I do. I'm an attacker. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that's not exactly my best trait. And it's something that I try desperately to alleviate myself from. But as we get rolling, I guess we'll get in gear here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here. I don't remember exactly. I think I did the second. This is my third time at this conference. I did the second, I think, and the third, and then now the sixth. And I remember, funny thing about that talk I gave on sponsorship. This is the only place I've ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous where I've had to give the same talk or talk on the same subject on the same day more than one time. It's just kind of unusual programming, but it's fine. But I remember I was asked to do a talk on sponsorship, and it was at 9 o'clock in the morning. And if you do this, look, if anybody talks at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, it's impossible when you're finished not to draw some conclusions of how you did or how you felt. It's not how you performed, because if it's that, you're in deep trouble. It's about, did you make sense? Did you offer something to someone? Did you share some experience in a way that's at least understandable in hopes that someone would benefit by it? And I just gave a talk, and I walked out of there, and I thought, God almighty, just flat. I was just so grateful I wasn't a newcomer sitting in the audience. And then I had to give the talk on sponsorship at 2 o'clock, and I was rocking and rolling. I mean, my mind was just clicking. I just stood here and it came out, and it was meaningful. It was real, and it was the way I would have wanted to hear it if I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked out of that room and I thought, good, I really put something in the pot today. And I didn't know that, but they taped the 9 o'clock. And I didn't know that until later. They taped the 9 o'clock. And to this day, I'm often in other parts of the country, and people walk up to me and say, I have this tape that you talked on sponsorship in Boca Raton, Florida, and it's just so wonderful. And I want to say, you should have been there at 2 o'clock. The power of these tapes. Tapes are such powerful things. When I first started doing this was a lot of years ago. And the first time someone came up to me and talked to me about my tape was in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, the home of a friend of mine who's now a long time deceased and a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was going to talk at his home group. And I was relatively I wasn't as new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was new in experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been around and involved in Alcoholics Anonymous for some period of time without really experiencing recovery or Alcoholics Anonymous. I just kind of was here, and I was just starting to break out of that mode. And I was asked to give this talk in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. And when I walked in, a woman rushed up to me and she said, "Oh my God, I have to talk to you. I just have to tell you that I have your tape, and you just don't know what it means to me. I listen to it all the time. It literally, I believe, has saved my life." And I thought, "Oh, that's neat." And I gave my talk. And the first person in the greeting line after my talk was this lady. And I put out my hand, and she grabbed my hand. She looked me right in the eye. She said, "I just want to tell you, I had you confused with someone else." And it's been pretty much like that ever since. I do a fair share of speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, when you do that, and there are so many tapes out like this, people come up to you in the strangest places and tell you, "God, I listened to your tape, and when you said, it was just like everything came together for me, and I know I've never said that." Not only have I never said it, I wouldn't say it, because I don't believe it. I mean, it's... And I'm sure Clancy has had hundreds and hundreds of such, you know, "Clancy, when you said..." And I'm thinking, "Oh, God, I wonder what he does." But, of course, I'm much more gentle than him. Well, it's funny. It really is... We have a subject, and the subject is home group, and I belong to a home group. Because this is a subject matter, and I'm not going to get into what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like now, because unfortunately for you, I also have to do a lead on Sunday morning, and so I'm not going to make you sit through parts of that twice. If you don't know who I am, and I know a lot of the people in this audience, you're going to have to trust the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I'm just going to ask you to presume for a little bit that I just belong here, and I really do. I drank as much as I could, and then I drank more. I mean, I drank as much as I could, and I drank more. And I don't have a dramatic drinking story. I have a dramatic recovery story, only dramatic to me. Only dramatic to me, not dramatic to the listener, because I'm a guy who doesn't do AA well, and I don't do it easy. And here I am over 25 years sober, and I still don't do it well, and I still don't do it easy. There are people that I see and meet in Alcoholics Anonymous that just seem to do this as a second nature. They just... I tell you, if in the morning, if it's a choice between the Wall Street Journal or sports page or the Big Book, I pick up the newspaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to work to pick up that book. I have to remind myself. I'm not one of those guys who enthusiastically gets up every morning and can't wait for the work day to be over so I can go to an AA meeting, or go to an AA meeting in the morning before I go to the office. I don't think like that. I mean, I'd like to stand up here and tell you that that's second nature to me, but it really isn't. I mean, I just find it hard to do, and I'm a loner. I'm just not a good... I'm a good joiner. I'm just not a good stayer. I mean, I don't do well with people. I don't do well one-on-one with people. I do well with big audiences because I'm protected. I'm separated from you, and this microphone separates me, so I can be... at ease, but who I am is a very private person, and I'm a private person, and yet I can't recover from alcoholism and maintain that, you see, which is a dilemma for alcoholics of my type. And left to my own devices, I want to do this by myself. I mean, I don't want to really do this with other people. I mean, there's a part of me that resists, constantly resists doing what is the best for me to do. I'm the kind of alcoholic that does things that you suggest I do, and it works, and as soon as it works, I want to not do it anymore. I want to stop doing it. I don't want to stop doing it, I just have other things to do. You see, when what you tell me to do starts to work for me, that's the way it ought to be. So now I get on with my life. Now, I don't know if that makes any sense for you, but for alcoholics of my type, it apparently does. So this is a learning process for me. Is there anybody here in this room that's got less than 90 days of sobriety? Anybody? Okay. And what's your name? What's your name, sir?
Wayne.
You and I are in exactly the same boat. I'm a little over 25 years sober, and in that sense, we're very similar. I'm an alcoholic, and presumably you are. I don't know that to be a fact, but if you're here and you walked in this door, I think it gives us some right to at least assume that you're here for a reason other than passing through. And in that sense, we're very much the same. If you're an alcoholic of my type, no matter how you cut it, you can't drink safely. And we're same in that. But in another sense, we're very different. It's much more important that I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous than it is for you. And that's true because I have more to lose than you do. It's taken me over 25 years to accumulate whatever I have accumulated in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't have another 25 years. I can't get it back. If I give it up, if I reject it, if I throw it away, if I waste it, I can't accumulate it again. I mean, I can't live that long, number one. Number two, I can't do this again. Maybe it's not because I can't, but I really desperately believe I wouldn't. Because I don't know if I could muster up the surrender again. I don't know if I can muster up the desperation again. I don't know. I'd like to think I would, but no, I don't want to think I would. Because if I thought I would, I'd start playing the game of maybe, just maybe. And I hope you understand that in the context at which I offer it to. It's not a criticism, but if you have 2 weeks of sobriety, you can get 2 weeks. You can do 2 weeks next month or next year, maybe. I can't do what I have. And plus, what I've acquired is so much greater than I ever thought I would get from Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, most of the time, what I got reluctantly. I received with some sense of pushing it away. I remember when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't come here enthusiastically. I came here with a sense of shame. If you ask me, what do you remember most about going to Alcoholics Anonymous? It was about shame. And yet the shame of how I was living was much greater than the shame of going into that room. But at that time, being a self-obsessed person, and truly I qualify 100% for self-obsession, the thing that bothered me worst about going to AA is I had this haunting question, how could I have done this to me? It's as if I brought myself to a disgusting level, I'd somehow driven myself to a place that I never wanted to go. And it was not the kind of place I ever hoped to end up. It was a place where losers go, I thought. It's a place where losers go. And I knew I was a loser, but I didn't want to be a loser. There's an acceptance that I just didn't want to make. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because on November 3rd, 1971, it just seemed to be an appropriate alternative for the day or the moment. I don't know that I never intended to stay here this long. I just never intended that I would be here this long. And And why I'm here is a long story, but I want to tell you a little story, just an anecdote. A while ago, a psychologist sought me out. I get sought out by various types that seem to like to talk to me. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and clergy. And I don't know what it is, but they like to engage me in conversation. And this psychologist, who is not a fan of Alcoholics Anonymous, who doesn't like Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sometimes feel sorry for her because I know that it, I think she just is envious of our of our success rate, and I think more, you know, we just see so many people recover from alcoholism in AA, and they don't even lay in couches. But I have nothing against sitting in front of a desk with a psychiatrist, psychologist, or psychiatrist. I have nothing against that. But she said, in reality, what you have done is you have simply transferred one dependency for another dependency. You are dependent on alcohol, and now you're dependent on a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. There has been no growth and no change. It is a dependency to a dependency. And I'm thinking, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, how long is she going to talk? And I didn't know how it'd penetrate her. What a terrible choice it was. Now you see, that's the kind of thing, that's what happens at 9 o'clock in the morning. That's a different subject. Dangerous. It's a dangerous thing here. And I didn't want to engage her in any real conversation because it makes no sense. We're not going to get anywhere. I'm never going to make her understand. There's no sense trying. It's just I'm old enough and long enough around Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that I cannot change the mindset of another human being, especially one who has no willingness to even consider the possibility that a change of that mindset could occur. Once they are set to believe that they believe and want nothing else to enter, nothing else will ever enter. And so I don't argue with people. I said, but let me just give you this to take back with you for whatever it's worth. You think and you view it as if I have gone and replaced one dependency for another dependency. Let me tell you how it feels inside me. I loved to drink. I was in love with drinking. I now love not having to drink. And I now love Alcoholics Anonymous. What I feel like I have done is I have transferred and substituted one love affair for another love affair. Thank you very much. And we've parted. And that's how I feel. I don't know about all this clinical stuff and all this, but I have transferred a love affair for a love affair. And that's just the way it is. And I truly do love Alcoholics Anonymous, even though often, more often than not, I have to be pushed. I have to be motivated. Left to my own devices, I don't do very well. I am a very bright guy, but I seem to be very dumb. I'm an energetic person, but I seem to have a laziness about me that is just hard to comprehend. It's just hard to comprehend. And yet, that's what it is. That's who I am. I'm very incomplete, not finished, maybe never finished kind of a guy who is doing better now than he ever did in his life. And that's the story of my journey to Alcoholics Anonymous and through Alcoholics Anonymous. I just am better today than I have ever been. Now, that's not every minute of every day and not every hour of every day, but if you take a wide picture of who I am now, I am a better person. I'm a good father. I never was a good father. I didn't know how to be a father. My children are all adults now, but I'm still their father. I'm very good at it. I have 7 grandchildren, and I am the best grandfather in the whole world. It's just, and I know some of you think you are, but that's okay. It's okay, and I'm privileged to have that experience. When I had my children, I was too busy. I don't remember my children. I don't remember my children growing up. I never changed a diaper. I don't remember ever feeding anybody. I just didn't. I was out doing other things. And when I stopped doing those things and I showed up, they had grown up. And with the grandchildren, it's so different because you're there from the very beginning. You see the beauty of that innocence, and you know that in that child is your hope for a better life. It's exciting. And so in that sense, I know about change. I know about change. I have a grandson, my oldest grandson, I talk a lot about. His name is Danny, and I see how I grew up through Danny. And Danny's going to be 7 and on the 15th of June, and Danny and I travel a lot, and we go to places together, and I learn about how I'm doing in Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm with Danny, and tell you a secret. It's a silly little story. It doesn't mean anything, but last year I decided that Danny would... I just want Danny to see and experience things. I don't want to tell him what to do. People have been telling me what to do all my life. And I told my kids what to do all their lives. I don't want to do that again. I decided we've done a lot of things. And I've just shown him that there are things and places and to experience. So I had an idea. I think I have to teach him about golf. Just let him know what golf is. And so I had somebody make a set of golf clubs. A golf manufacturer made a set of golf clubs. And that's kind of neat. I mean, I never had a golf club when I was a kid. I thought that was kind of neat. And they got a miniature bag. And I put it all together, and I went over to Danny's house, and I said, "Danny, I got something to show you." And I opened the trunk of my car. I said, "Look at that." He said, "What's that, Papa?" I said, "Those are golf clubs." I said, "What do you do with them?" He said, "I said, well, you play golf, and I'm going to take you to a golf course, and we're going to get some balls, and I'll show you how to do it." And I went to this golf course, and they had the golf range, and I got the biggest bucket of balls they had. I don't know why, I just like stuff big, you know. I mean, and so it was a big bucket of balls, and I don't know, it may have been 300 balls, I don't know, just a large bucket of balls. And I put them down, and I put one on a tee, and I brought some clubs along for myself, and I said, "Watch this, Danny," and I hit just this 5-iron, it was just like, you know, you wanted to scream, "Hey, Mrs. Woods, could your son come out to play?" I mean, it was just wonderful, and he didn't have anything to relate to, so he didn't know it was such a great deal. And finally, I got Danny to stand right, hold the club, hit a ball, and he hit one, and he hit two, he hit three, and he hit 5 or 6, and missed 8 or 9. And within 2 minutes, he said, "Papa, I don't want to do this anymore." And I said, "Okay, Danny, we won't." And we didn't. Then we put the clubs away and put them in the car, and we walked away from the bucket of balls. I could not have done that. I would have to tell him how important it was to him to realize how much it cost to have those clubs made. I would have had to tell him about gratitude. I would have had to tell him about how much those balls cost to rent and about his obligation to finish what he starts. And on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And all I said is, "Okay, Danny, that's it." And that's an AA story. That's a recovery story. Now, you may not be able to relate to that, but I'll tell you what, that's a mirror for me. The change has occurred. I don't know if he'll ever play golf. I really couldn't care less. Because, you see, I no longer direct the lives of others. And that's this AA story. And for me, that's the story of recovery. And I'm not God. It took a long time, and I still struggle with that sometime, but it's a big deal. It's a big deal to learn, number one, that I'm not God, and I don't have to play God. It's a big deal. It really is a big deal. And hopefully I've learned it a lot. I don't know that I can practice it every day. I'm a member of a group called the... I almost said Lamont Oaks Raiders. Isn't that funny how that came to my mind? The people from my home... There are people from my home group here. Anybody from my home group, please raise their hand. That's why they snickered, because someone named us that years ago. And I'll get into that story a little bit later. But what I want to do here in the few minutes that we have is to explore the possibilities. And Wayne, I want to tell you why it might be important for people like you, assuming, of course, that you relate to anything that is said here today. To be important for you to consider the possibility that you might also want to participate in a home group experience. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to a meeting, and I went to that meeting regularly, but I was best described as a floater, and I am comfortable as a floater. Floaters have this going for them. They never have to really let anyone know who they are. And you never have to get close to anyone. And for people like me, that's an important safeguard. That's a comfort level that I seek naturally, not getting to know you and not allowing you to know me. It's not an arrogance. It's a self-obsession, maybe. Maybe it's just an inability to cope with the responsibilities of that kind of a sharing process. I don't know what it is. I just I don't spend a lot of time trying to figure that out. I just don't. But the neat thing about also about being a person who just floats in Alcoholics Anonymous is you're not accountable. It's so wonderful to not be accountable. Because you see, if you're not there, they don't notice it. And often, I don't want to be there. And when I know that I don't have a commitment, and I really don't know them, and they don't know me, it's just easier not to go. It's just easier to realize that I haven't seen that movie that's coming on at 8 o'clock, or I really ought to go do this or do that, or maybe I ought to just lay on the couch, or what's the difference? It's just easier for me to not do the things that were suggested by people who seem to be doing well. Just easier. And so early on, it was as if I was monitoring the meetings. I wasn't participating in the meetings when I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just there. And I was just waiting for something to happen, I think I was doing time. I don't know that I was even waiting for... See, there's one thing nice about going to A meetings when you're new. You're safe. You're safe. If nothing else, for that time, in that room, when that door is closed, I'm safe. Nobody's going to hurt me. There are no demands on me. I'm just okay. And if nothing else, to me, that was a big deal. Also, I found that it was interesting listening to the people in those rooms, for the most part, because I understood more listening from them than I ever remember understanding from any other type person, because I can't stand superficial stuff. I just don't do well in social environments where people have this level of superficial, how are you? I'm fine. How's Agnes? Agnes is good. And where'd you go on vacation this year? Oh, we went to on a cruise. And I want to talk about stuff like remorse. Guilt. Anger. Self-obsession. Self-loathing. God, this is... Even if I don't want to talk, I'd like to listen to you talk about self-loathing, you know. So, being alone, being a floater in Alcoholics Anonymous has its attractive to me when I'm new to Alcoholics Anonymous. The problem that occurred in my life was that as long as I did that, I also found it easy not to do much else. And although I wasn't drinking, the not drinking was more as a result of a respite provided by this safe environment as it was any kind of recovery. There was no real recovery taking place. There was the absence of alcohol, reinforced by the good words and subject matters of the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. But there was no recovery taking place. There was just the absence of alcohol. And anybody who tells you, well, I don't want to say that. I used to use phrases like, anybody else that tells you this is wrong. And I used to live in a world of certainty. Now, I never say anything certain anymore because I'm always wrong when I say that. And some people act as if the absence of alcohol in an alcoholic has very little benefit. Well, I'm one that tells you there's a lot of benefit in just being sober. There is a... Well, you know the benefit. You get up in the morning, you go like this, you look out, and there's your car. that's a good feeling. You open your eye, and it's your wall. You realize that you remember going to bed. You remember taking your clothes off. I didn't always take my clothes off when I went to bed. Sometimes I just lay down for a second. That's just the way it was. I had a day like that yesterday that reminded me of the early days. I called my wife last night after the meeting just to check in and see how everybody's doing because I'm the head of our family. I am. It's different now. I was the head. I was the dominant controller of my family. Now I have the responsibility to care for the welfare of those people. I have three sons-in-laws. I have three daughters. I have a wife. I have seven grandchildren. And I am the head of the family. I'm the elder. And my responsibility is to be concerned for the welfare of that unit. That's how I'm the head of the family. But it has nothing to do to directing how they live or how they think or how they act. Now, that's a difference. That's an AA story. That's a story of recovery. And yet I can't get into that. I can just tell you that that's how I see it. That's a difference. I never thought that would occur. I never thought that that would be a good result. I always thought being the dominant controlling, because I know better. You see, I should be the dominant controller because I know better. I know how people ought to live. I really do. I just instinctively, I have a good sense of how you ought to live. But I called my wife last night and she said, how you doing or how's it going or something. I don't know what she says. And what she said, and I had a wonderful day. I said, I just had a peaceful day. I spent the entire day around a pool with a bunch of nice people and nothing occurred and it was just a comfortable day and Clancy and I laid out for a few hours and I don't know what we talked about. We really didn't talk about anything. We just experienced each other. I don't remember anything he said. I really mean it. We just experienced the fact that we're getting older and we're activists in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said we're all ended up in the same place. And I remember he said that. And there were other people, some of them people I know from my group, and some others, people I've known, and came around and spent a minute here, 5 minutes there. And then we went out and had a just a comfortably simple dinner. Nobody dominated the conversation. I don't know what the hell we talked about. We just kind of had a nice dinner. Then we came back and we went to an AA meeting and heard a real neat guy talk about his life, and the day was over. I said it was just a wonderful day. What made it wonderful is I don't regret anything that happened yesterday. That's a new experience for me. I don't know about you, but my whole life I've lived in regret. I still can't take for granted the fact that maybe for you that's the way it ought to be. Just ordinarily wonderful, clean, wholesome, and easy days. Maybe that's the way it ought to be, but that's not the way it is for me. I mean, that's a wonderful exception that occurs more now than ever before in my life. And that's the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's kind of a story of recovery. And I didn't get to experience that by being a floater in Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as I was a floater in alcohol, and I only talk about me, I'm not here to tell anybody how they ought to, what they ought to do, or how they ought to think, or if they ought to modify their mode of participation. That's not my purpose. I'm only here to say how this journey. As long as I was a floater, I never experienced those kinds of moments. Because see, one of the roots of that day that was so simple and yet so wonderful is I was with other people. I was involved in other people on a level equal to them. And there was no jockeying for position. There was no qualifying as to self-worth or importance. There was just guys and gals together. And I don't do that naturally. I never thought that ever be possible. And it just happened. And people who don't know what I'm talking about will never know what I'm talking about. But I'll call to my type. And I never want to take those days for granted. And then I thought to myself, I've had a lot of those days. And when I have them, I don't celebrate them enough. I don't say, good. I tend to take it for granted. And just kind of yawn, oh, another safe, clean, good day. You see, the alcoholic that I'm, the type of alcoholic I am, one of my sponsors, a fellow that I had as a sponsor, Clancy knows him, named Bill D. in Pittsburgh. Wonderful man. He and I are still so very, very close. He said, Frank, all you need to be happy is something is more and something different. And he always talked that way. He was a crazy guy. He just helped me so much. He'd say, I understand, Frank, you'll be happy when you get more and something different. I remember one time I called him about, years and years ago, I called him about whether or not I might have this short affair. I mean, it wasn't going to be an affair. It was just going to be a... I know I can't do affairs. I can't do... My mind can't do that. But... And he said... And I said, this is a long, long time ago. Long, long time ago. This... And it really was. Okay? And this person had come into my office and was just... kind of said things that kind of say, do you want to? And I called him and I said, what do you think, Bill? He says, would it be dangerous? I said, yeah. She got a husband? I said, yeah. Do you think he would be upset? I said, and if he found out, I said, yeah. He said, could, if you do it, could it blow up and literally negatively affect your life? I said, I guess so. He said, I'd do it. and so I understood. I understood instantly. I can't do it. But he never told me I couldn't do it. He always would point out to me the other side of the coin and said, well, I guess you ought to do it. See, he knew me. If he knew that I'm the type of alcoholic, if someone says, you don't do that, I would think, okay? He knows that. So what he would do is he'd show me the big picture. And when I see the big picture, it's obvious what the answer is. My problem is I don't sometimes see the big picture. Oh, I see the big picture when it comes to your life. But when it comes to my life, sometimes I zero in on the exception and focus on that and miss the rule and miss the big picture. And what his magic for me was to hold a mirror up that would reflect not only my image, but all that is around me and all that's in back of me and all that's on either side of me until I could see. And when I see that full picture, there's no doubt what's the right thing for me to do. And I know I'm not supposed to talk on sponsorship, but that's one of the tools that I have used to save my life. Home group is another tool. I don't use a home group to keep me sober. My participation in a home group today is not designed to keep me from taking the first drink. For me, my participation in my group is designed to keep me going to AA. You see, a lot of people don't go to AA and don't drink. A lot of problem drinkers, in my experience, alcoholics, in my experience, don't drink and don't go to AA. I give you a perfect example. My father, all my life, acted, lived as an active alcoholic. I don't stand in judgment. That's just how we lived. We lived in an alcoholic home with its nightmares and its screams and its knives and its guns and its tears and its blood and its ups and downs and inconsistencies that just baffled your mind as to what was right and what was wrong and what was real and what was a dream, bad or good. And the day he heard that I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, he told my mother, I will never drink again. And I will offer that up so that Frank won't drink because I caused his drinking. He said that, and he's never had a drink. And he's 25 years sober. Never went to an AA meeting. And I've met people who've gone to treatment centers and psychiatrist's offices and gone to confessions in Catholic churches and other places of worship and made promises and took vows and have never drank again. I mean, it just seems to be human experience. I tried all those other things. And every time I tried to not drink doing those other things, I invariably drank again. My hat's off to the people who can do it that way. I can't. And so I don't. But if I could write a check and relieve myself from alcoholism and all of its fallout, I'd write that check. If I could go to a priest and get forgiveness and espouse a sense of sorrow sufficient to warrant that redemption, as we heard, I would do it. And if that would enable me to not drink and live happily ever after, I would do it. I can't do it. I've tried. I have prayed. I have promised. I have hoped. I have investigated. I have read. I have committed. I have pledged. I'm just tired. I've just done it all. And invariably, I drink, and again, and again, and again. The only place I have ever had any success in disrupting that pattern of self-destruction, that self-loathing, that confusion of who the hell I am and why am I here, those questions that have no answers, is here in this environment called Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet the damnedest thing about it is I'm a type of alcoholic that just has emotional and enthusiasm levels like this. I'd love to be able to say, look it, I'm a guy who's an activist in Alcoholics Anonymous, who sponsors a lot of people, and I do it. I'm just a guy who's committed to his home group, and I am, and I spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous doing what I'm doing here today, and I do all this because it's just the way it is for me, and this is what I want to do. And I would love to say that. It's not true. Sometimes my enthusiasm is up here, and then sometimes it's just down there. And then it's up, and then it's down, then it's flat, then it's up, then it's down, and that's the experience of 25-plus years of involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could just get it to a high and just keep it there. It's just, I seem to be a changing person in a changing environment that simply is always in some struggle with something, most often my own mind or my own emotions. That's just the way it is, and I'm not trying to be Freudian, or that's just the way it is. I need constant monitoring. I'm just the kind of alcoholic that it's the damnedest thing. I'm pretty successful in my life. I really am. I've been successful in a lot of things I've done in a worldly type situation. But I don't motivate myself well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I discovered early on that I will do for others things I will not do for myself. I found that first to be true in my earliest meaningful sponsorship relationship. I did things for Bill Dixon that I would not do for myself. I behaved in manners for him in a way that I would never behave for myself. You say I wanted his approval? I don't know if I wanted his approval. Maybe it was. I don't know. Who cares? Often I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous I get the right results with the wrong intentions. I mean, and that's just the way it is for me. I don't know how it is for you. It's just not easy for me. And yet there's sometimes it just smoothly. We were sitting at dinner, and I was looking out the window yesterday, and I with all these ladies and two young men from our group. And I remember one day on the beach in Naples, I was with Clancy and a bunch of guys, and we're walking down the beach, and a boat came by, and I thought to myself, God, how nice it would be to be on that boat. And then a couple of years ago, I was made president of a large company that has a big yacht. And my wife and I were on the yacht, and we were going around the whole state of Florida on our yacht. And I'm looking at the people on the beach and wondering how nice it would be to be walking on the beach. I'm committed to my group, and here is what it costs me. I have to be willing to let people know who I am, to be accountable. I have to be willing to be less obsessed, at least enough, to care about who who you are and to be open to an awareness of what your needs might be. I have to have a surrender. We have a wonderful group. We have a group that we can truly be proud of. We started with 8 guys, and now we have up to 600 people at our closed meeting. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of years of sobriety in the group. If you come to our group, and some of you have been there, just at our regularly scheduled meeting, you'll see little things. The meeting always starts on time because we're accountable to be consistent in our behavior, and we're an 8:30 meeting that starts at 8:30. At 2 minutes to 8:30, the room goes quiet, and then someone stands up and goes, ding, ding, ding. He's our bell. And that's the official notice. Nobody gets up, walks around. Nobody goes and gets coffee. Halfway through the meeting, there's a 5-minute break. Coffee is brought to the people. No one has to get up. No one leaves. During the meeting, people don't talk to each other. They don't laugh. They don't hold conversations. The meeting promptly closes. And before anyone leaves the room, everyone in the room thanks the speakers. I learned that from that man. See, why do you thank speakers? He says, then you don't have to decide who you like and who you don't. Who you think gave a good talk and who you didn't think you agreed with. And more importantly, I came to learn what's wrong with common courtesy in Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll say thank you to a waitress we'll never see again, and all she did was set a cup of coffee in front of us. And some poor, nervous member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's not comfortable in a public speaking environment will stay up all night worrying about giving this 10-minute talk. Get there and do the best they can and show you the love and respect they have from Alcoholics Anonymous. And as soon as they're done, we'll walk out to have a cigarette. We won't give that person the same courtesy that we would give that waitress who simply put a cup down in front of us. And we thank everybody. And here's the interesting thing. If you ever saw 600 people wait in line, you come to understand very quickly one thing. It takes a long time to get to the speaker, which means you have to wait in line for a long time. Wayne, if you ever want to learn about patience, the best way to learn to be patient is to wait in line. And there's a dynamic power evident when you see all the people who are very busy. They all have busy lives. They have busy families. They have busy children. They have busy things to do tomorrow. They have busy unfinished things to do tonight, and it's almost 10 o'clock at night. But they don't have the need to attend to those things until they fulfill their obligation of simple common courtesy. I learned that as an involved member of the Lamont Oaks group of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I don't want to go to meetings, and there are times I just think, God, I'm tired. I'm just tired. I've been all weekend out in Hoboken trying to wait in airports to give this AA talk, and here it's Monday already, and my weekend is gone, and I can't not go because they know me. They know where I sit. And maybe for the wrong reason, I don't want to have to answer, where were you, Frank? I just show up. Now, that's a silly way to have to deal at age 59 and a half and 25 years sober. It shouldn't have to be that way. But it is that way, and it's okay because it works that way. And I'm like so many other people. I'm still here while most of the people that came have left. Thank you very much.